So how do you bring something, the idea of nonviolence, in your everyday life?
By understanding what's going on inside, the first person you actually harmed was yourself. And then the next question came along, why on earth do you want to hurt you?
Being on the top of the evolutionary curve, we're the only ones that every day, we don't want to be angry.
I'd love to add something to that, because it's great what you just said. But in reality, I should be thanking the other person. Because they've reminded me of a trigger that is still yet unresolved.
The final product that you've been working on is you, because you're always going to have the right skill set, the right mindset, resilience, whatever it takes. You're going to have that.
And look at some of the greats. You know, you mentioned a few names earlier. They had the same 24 hours. They did amazing things. What did they do different that you're not able to do?
But the moment you identify yourself as cosmic, that means everything in the cosmos is a part of your identity.
To forgive is to set the prisoner free, only to realize the prisoner was you.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Ship with CJ podcast. Today I am excited to introduce you to Sahil Mehta. Sahil is an extraordinary individual who has mastered the art of decluttering in his life. Sahil is an entrepreneur, he's a coach, he's a passionate mountaineer, and he's the author of an awesome book that gives you practical insights on how to declutter your life and really find that true meaning that most of us are looking for. I was honestly thrilled to have Sahil in the studio and talk to him. I had a bunch of questions for him, and if you have a lot going on in your life, this episode is for you. One of my favorite lessons from Sahil's book is why worry? It's an analogy that he describes in the book, which we get into the podcast. So get ready to get some valuable insights, some wisdom, and a lot of practical tips. Let's welcome the amazing Sahil Mehta. Today, I'm so excited to have Sahil on the show. Sahil Mehta, welcome to the show.
So glad to be here, CJ.
I'm so glad to have you. You know, Sahil, when I was reading your book, my sister was over from work, but she doesn't live with her. And I was making notes, and in the middle of making notes, because I was aware that she was going to leave soon, I was running down, I was telling her, did you know about this? And do you know about this? And then my mom's looking at me and she's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, I'm interviewing this guy, and then I have his book, and your book was on my table for some time. So the first day that I got it, they were like, who's this guy? And I'm like, I'm going to be interviewing him. And then they were like, oh, okay, perfect. And my sister is like, okay, interesting. And then I talked to her about three things. I'm like, try it out and let me know how it is. And then I run back up to write some notes. So it's super interesting. And I'm intrigued to share with the audience, how can they break free and declutter their life? Shall we begin?
Let's go.
Let's do it. Okay, perfect. So I've made, you know, honestly, I don't think we'll be able to complete all my questions in this podcast because I have so many. It's so many pieces of wisdom that you're sharing through your work. And I'm going to try my best for all of you guys to ask the most interesting things that I found after reading the book. Okay, question one. This is interesting because you have gone through all these mountains, right? Like you've summited all these mountains, which are very difficult. I know, I've heard from a lot of people. And on this quest, like, you know, one of the things you speak about early in the book is the concept of ahimsa or nonviolence. But at the other side, you're kind of like going at the extreme and, you know, conquering all of these summits. So how do you bring something as nonviolence, the idea of nonviolence in your everyday life?
So this concept, like many things, people usually look outward. Mm-hmm. They look, you know, I shouldn't be mean to someone. I shouldn't use words that would hurt them. I shouldn't use physical violence, etc. But what I would love the audience to think about is what it means within themselves. Because mm-hmm. really, violence stems from within. So by understanding what's going on inside, you get a much better grasp on violence. And let me give you an example. I used to lose my temper. And I would say my fuse was relatively short, okay? When I came across this concept, I said, Sahil, the first person you actually harmed was yourself. Before I unleashed, whether it was usually verbal and unfortunately sometimes physical, I didn't realize that the pain I caused first was to myself. And then the next question came along, well, why on earth do you want to hurt you? And so when I had that realization, I started asking myself, is it worth it? Because if every time I lose my temper, I'm hurting myself again and again and again. And what is that effect having on my body, on my mind? And how's that then impacting how I interact with other people? So it's almost like I was getting into this vicious downward cycle. Mm-hmm. But when I came to know that I was harming me, and I'm pretty sure that most people don't want to harm themselves, then it begged the question, well, if I don't want to harm myself, how else can I respond? And I use the word respond because before I would react. Mm-hmm. And you know, my coach, who's an amazing human being, she shared the story with me. She said, Sahil, imagine yourself to be a horse and a horse rider. In general, you're the horse rider and you're directing the horse. Go fast, go slow, turn left, right, jump, stop, etc. But when those emotions really rise, and I'm going to stick to anger, you start to transition from the horse rider to the horse. And all of a sudden, you're a wild animal. You can't necessarily control your actions or what you say. And then if we fast forward a little bit, it usually ends with, I wish I didn't do that. Mm. Or I wish I didn't say that. And so we all know when anger's rising or any emotion that's not serving us, because we start feeling these sensations in our body. So with a high level of awareness, I catch myself and I go, whoa, 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 whoa. And then it's time to take a pause. So mid-conversation, I might start with some breath work, or I might just walk out of the room, because I'd much rather say nothing than say something or do something that I'd regret. Mm. And so it's like, how do you then transition back to the horse rider? After which you can still be angry, but at least you're responding rather than reacting.
I love that. I love that the analogy is super cool for people to use it. You know, we're the only species on the planet that engage in self-sabotaging behaviors. When you look at the animal world, 99% of them were not going to come harm to themselves. Mm. Okay, they might cause some harm to like the other animals in the pack or somewhere, but when it comes to themselves, they're very selective. They're not going to cause any harm. And human beings, being on the top of the evolutionary curve, we're the only ones that every day we don't want to be angry. That's what we tell ourselves. But there are certain neurochemicals that rise up in situations like this, and those become addictive. And this is where you spoke about awareness, and this is the key. Once you understand that a certain action is going to end up in a situation which is not favorable for you, for everyone else, it's that, you know, you mentioned something so interesting, that ability to respond. Mm-hmm. Between every stimulus and action, there is a tiny gap, and that's where your ability to respond or responsibility comes in. And I love that you said that. Okay, cool.
I'd love to add something to that, because it's great what you just said. And I used to find that when I did lose my temper, because again, it's, you know, that awareness, and then you start to reflect and you go, what happened? Mm-hmm. And quickly I realized that I was judging. Okay? Because basically someone pressed a trigger in me. Mm-hmm. And that must have brought out some unresolved issue from the past, however long back it was, whether it was one day, one week, one year, a a decade, even from childhood, whatever it is. And rather than being curious, because that I find is the opposite of being judgmental, rather than being curious and understanding their viewpoint, I judged and I unleashed. But in reality, I should be thanking the other person, because they've reminded me of a trigger that is still yet unresolved, which gives me the opportunity, and I use the word opportunity because it really is that, to ask myself, okay, where is this coming from? Like, should I really be losing my temper so badly over such a small thing or meat, whatever it is? Clearly it was big for you, but in the grand scheme of things, when you reflect on it, many times you realize it wasn't that big an issue. But it was a trigger that cut deep, mm-hmm. something you had unresolved. And so now, when I feel that anger coming and I go through that breath work, I just ask myself, one, let me make sure I understand their perspective, because I'm sure they weren't trying to harm me. And two, what trigger just got pressed that is still not resolved? Because by identifying that gives me the opportunity to resolve it and hence grow as a human being.
That's super interesting. That takes a lot of awareness and a lot of wisdom, which you have accumulated over your lifetime and with all the great mentors and all your family members that you give credit to very early in the book, which is something really great. When I was seeing that, I haven't seen many people do that in so much detail. So kudos to you for that. Tony Robbins also mentioned something along the lines of, I'm paraphrasing it, like, don't be cheap with your emotions. So if something triggers you, make sure it's really, really huge, because don't let people's opinions or just small things, small bits of angriness affect you, because, you know, your emotions shouldn't be so cheap. It shouldn't go with anything and everything. Be very, very selective about it. So yeah, that's something interesting. We see a similar pattern. A lot of people, what you spoke about earlier was a lot of people look at the outside world on how can they change someone, something on the outside. So a typical thing would be, hey, I'm practicing nonviolence, so I'm not going to engage in a physical fight, or I'm going to be vegan or vegetarian. That's a lot. That's where the entire world is looking at. Very few people, and you've said it beautifully, I've never heard someone say it as beautifully as you, that look at the inside first. No, violence doesn't mean harming others. It all starts with you first. And of course, you know, you've got Mahatma Gandhi, you have Martin Luther King Jr., you have Dalai Lama. And I think one of the initial word comes from a person from like a yogic background, a sage called Patanjali. And he has these four or five yamas and niyamas. And one of them is nonviolence. And there are a lot of other things. But super interesting. Okay, let's talk about something. There was a very cool quote in the book. It says, it takes one to change a few to change many, many to change the world. And I think this is such a powerful message, because a lot of the times, do you see this, that people always say that, hey, I'm just one person, I can't be the change. And what I think is, a lot of people want to be the change to be rewarded in the present moment and or be rewarded really soon. But oftentimes, people who start the change, it takes a long time for them to be recognized or rewarded. And most of the times, like, people who really started changes, like, they were dead, and then generations later, that change became the way it is, and a lot of people benefited. So that's why, that's how I see, as people are always looking at life in terms of transactions. And if you can, if you want to engage in something difficult or go against the world in literally or figuratively, you're not going to be rewarded. Do you see this mentality of people around you? Or
absolutely. You think of the world with 8-9 billion people and you're one. Whatever I do, is it really going to make an impact? And when you were sharing that story, it reminded me of when I wrote the book. When I wrote the book, I was lucky that I had a lot of free time back in 2020. So I was writing the book, and it got released in 2021, January. But there was this moment where when I clicked send on my computer, there was no turning back. And the imposter syndrome and all sorts of other things kicked in. And I had to remind myself, because, you know, again, just to give you an idea, in English literature, in my GCSEs, I got a B. I didn't even get an A. So I'm thinking, you know, I'm not even that great a writer. What if people think my book is rubbish and all that stuff? But then based on the quote you just shared, I asked myself, why did you write the book? Or why are you writing this book? It's so that people who can't get access to you have a low price point to which they can get all the information and learn from it. And I said, even if I get thousands, if not millions of people saying it's absolute rubbish, if one person, whether they tell me or they don't, but it impacts their life in a positive way, I've contributed to benefiting someone else's life. And you know, they always say, you don't remember what people may tell you, but you always remember how they make you feel. And so that one person, it's very possible that they then share their life experience with, usually I think that, you know, when someone has a good experience, they share it with at least three people, if I'm not mistaken. And so then it starts to spread. And okay, it may not happen this lifetime, but if that continues to spread year after year, generation after generation, maybe after a few decades, a lot of people are talking about it. But it's not about me getting fame. It's about me making impact. And I don't need to be rewarded for it. I just feel it's our duty to make the world a better place. But the one thing I didn't realize when I wrote the book is that the first person it actually helped was me. And so by wanting to create a positive impact in the world, it's amazing how much you as an individual improve. And when you improve, and that's the energy that you're giving out, those are the type of people you'll start to attract in your life. And they listen to you, you listen to them, you learn from each other, and you're sharing each other's stories. And so that impact through the ripple effect just starts to spread.
I always tell people, like, hey, listen, if you heard a nice joke and it really made you laugh, you're going to go and tell two more people.
Yes.
And when it comes to the world of, I mean, I look at a lot of things from the business standpoint, and there's an influencer out there. His name is Alex Hormozi. I'm sure you've heard about him. And he says that a lot of the times, you might be, as an entrepreneur, you might be struggling to get to a certain point and you're going to make so many changes, but it's not your company which is going to be the final product. It is you. So through the process of trial and error, learning and adaptation, struggling, looking at highs and lows, the final product that you've been working on is you, because you're always going to have the right skill set, the right mindset, resilience, whatever it takes. You're going to have that. And another thing he also mentions is, like, he talks a lot about advertising and marketing and Facebook ads. But he's like, which I was thinking now is, he said, you would not want to spend any dollars on ad marketing if every customer that you had tells 1.2 more people about it. So I would say like two people. So if every customer you had tells two more people about your product, that means your product is so good, you wouldn't want paid marketing. But till the time you make your product so good, you've got to use marketing and other tools to kind of like make it the best product out there. So super interesting. Okay. Now, in your book, you have an exercise, and I don't know what you call it, but I called it the labels exercise, because you said in the book, identify all the labels that have been put on you by yourself and by the rest of the world. What is the impact of labels in our life?
With the label, I guess it has a lot of other identifiers with it. Like, for example, something that many people can relate to is your nationality. Because when you were born, you actually had no nationality. You had no name. You didn't have any label. Maybe the only label that you had was you were a son or a daughter. Maybe that's the first label that comes along when you're born. But a nationality, once you say, let's say I'm from the UAE, since we're sitting here right now. Now, maybe that comes with certain stereotypes, that I am this because I'm from the UAE, or I'm not this because I'm from the UAE. And we start believing that. But is that really who you are? Or is it just the preconditioning of society or your respective community? And that might also come with another major label, which is religion. Mm-hmm. That because I am this, it means I need to ... Mm-hmm. And then it could even go at a more molecular level, that I'm a member of this family and this is how our family operates. I'm a student in this school and this is what a student in this school represents. And so forth. You get my point. It's just one label after another. And then you start believing that identity is you. Mm-hmm. But who said that? And sometimes you don't feel it. You don't feel some of those things. You might agree on many points, but there are many points you go, actually, no, I don't feel that that's me. And so the whole point of the exercise is, what are the labels that have been put on you? Because that's not who you are. So start stripping them away. Mm-hmm. Even name. I was given the name Sahil. What does that even mean? You know, some people say, oh, my name is this. It's, they reference to a prophet or they reference to a meaning of the name. Mm-hmm. And they're like, that's me. But is that? Because again, when you were born, that didn't exist. And so as people want to discover, and it goes in the exercise of who am I in the book, mm-hmm. is once to discover who you truly are, you first have to make sure that you strip away all the labels that, as you mentioned, that you have put or others have put on you to commence on that journey.
I love that. Identity is a very strong driving force for most of the things that happen to us and are happened by us. You mentioned, you could take an identity of being in a certain country or school or religion. But when we look at some of the more extreme things out there, and I know, I'm sorry, guys, I just want to talk about some extremism. A lot of the people that are not doing great things in life, whether it's suicide bombing or bombing other countries or whatever, terrorism activities, the reason why they're doing it is because they're identified with a belief system so deeply that they think that is the end all be all. No person on this planet wants to take his own life. Like, when we look at animals, like we observe this in nature, you look at some animal, you try to catch it, they're not going to give up. They will try everything. You take a small ant, try to hold a small ant. That ant will do everything possible to get out and to live, because life on all levels is very precious and we want to save it. So for someone to give away their life and to take life of other people, that means that their identity is so deeply ingrained in that belief that they don't care about anything else. And when we reverse engineer it and we break it down and we bring it out into our everyday lives, it causes limitations. It causes, like, your, let's take the horse example. You're a horse with a blindfold and you cannot see what's really out there because your identity is messing up with your brain. Sometime back, I started doing this exercise. I started looking at all the things that I label myself as. And this is why it also helps you go to sleep, because it becomes very boring, so you fall asleep. So one of the exercises that I do before going to sleep is that, okay, I am CJ. I'm an entrepreneur, or I'm a podcaster. And then I keep telling myself, okay, I'm not a podcaster. I'm not an entrepreneur. So I try to consciously for some time let go of that label.
Because these are all the things that I am saying, or some of my, you know, three close friends are saying, or that I am. But that's not what I truly am. And the moment I kind of keep identifying with this, I cannot get out of that box. In India, there's a really cool thing. Long time back, the way the education system was designed was that before the age of 8 or 10, you're not allowed to like read books or do anything. You're just observing life, being outside, enjoying. And the only one thing or a mantra that the kids are taught, even now and maybe in the mountains, this is a thing. It's called Aham Brahmasmi, which translates to my identity is cosmic. Because the moment you said, like, you know, you identify with smaller groups of things, you're only going to act in accordance to what benefits that certain group of people, place, population. But the moment you identify yourself as cosmic, that means everything in the cosmos is a part of your identity. And then it, for an intelligence like ours, it doesn't take much prompt to not harm someone, not take care of the planet, not, you know, not cause any harm, basically, because you're just identified with, you don't have a limited identity. You're identified with everything. So here's,
I just want to say, sorry, that's a very, very powerful statement, because that truly is, and gives us a clear definition of oneness, of being connected. And so in a way, if I'm harming you, I'm harming myself.
Yeah.
So I love what you just shared. That's beautiful.
Thank you. Okay, then, in chapter 2 of your book, you make a statement, which is very interesting. It's also about common beliefs, three common beliefs, that we are normally looking in the wrong direction. So most of the people think that happiness lies in the outside world, there is not enough time in the day, and that spending time with your own self or one's own self is challenging. Why do you think these are the wrong directions? Because if I call in 10 people in the room, 10 out of 10, 9 out of 10 will say all of these things are true. And one person might have the imposter syndrome, but deep down he knows this is true as well. So most of the people think that these things are true.
Well, let's take them one at a time.
Okay.
So, you know, people are looking in the wrong direction. They're looking outward for happiness. You know, it's so common. I coach lots of executives. I you know, conversations with yourself and lots of other interesting people around the world, many people will tell me, oh, when I get this promotion, I'll be happy. When I get this car, I'll be happy. When I get married, I'll be happy. When I have children, I'll be happy. When I buy my dream house, I'll be happy. So it's very conditional. And it's conditional on external circumstances that may or may not happen. So you've given the power to something else, a person or a material thing, for your happiness. Whereas you have a choice. You can choose to be happy or not happy. It's your choice. So that's what I mean by we're looking in the wrong direction. Because everyone, you know, even if you look at these ads on TV, right? They show you, you use this laundry detergent, your clothes will smell so fresh and you'll be happy. So, you know, everything is, they do it so well psychologically. Yeah. But whatever their product that they're selling or experience, it usually ends with a man or a woman or a family with big smiles on their face and dancing, or they have a lot of joy in their life. And you go, oh, I want to be like that. And so you go and you say, I want to buy that brand. Okay. So again, we're looking outward, whereas it's really a choice. The second one is there's not enough time. There's not enough time in the day. Oh, I get that all the time. I used to say that all the time. Forget about talking about others. I used to say, I just don't have enough time in the day. And look at some of the greats. You know, you mentioned a few names earlier. They had the same 24 hours. They did amazing things. What did they do different that you're not able to do? And one of the things that I found is a similarity amongst all these great leaders is they had very clear vision on what they wanted to do in life, like what success meant to them. Very clear. And that allowed for a very high level of focus. And in not all cases, but in many cases, they also then took care of their body and mind so that it wouldn't become a distraction, because poor health is going to be a distraction. If I'm with better health, I can do the same amount of work in much less time. So before, if I just look at life prior to making several changes, getting home late, not spending enough time with the kids, no time for hobbies. You know, these are some of the things that were challenges myself. Now I'm running multiple businesses. I get to travel, mountaineering, go-kart racing, play tennis, like all the things I love doing, I'm doing them on a regular basis. I'm coming home earlier to spend time with the children, because I shifted the things that didn't really matter in my life based on the direction I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. And so when I eliminated those things, time freed up. So there are enough hours of the day. It's just, where's your focus? What, you know, do you have clarity on what success means to you? Because then it becomes easy to say no when something is not aligned with the direction you wish to go.
A lot of people's focus these days are on social media.
Yeah, on, you know, social media, it could be watching countless hours of TV. Mm-hmm. It could be finding it hard to say no when mm-hmm. people ask you for favors or invites or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And so you just get, I wouldn't say locked or forced, because ultimately it was your choice, mm-hmm. but you get stuck in these activities that have no value for you, just because you didn't have clarity, and hence it made it, or you found it very difficult to say no.
Mm-hmm. Also, one of the things that I wanted to add there is that when we have a clearly defined goal, right, or a vision, a lot of your brain circuitry starts to change. And of course, you become more focused and you pay more attention on things, because your brain gets like this singular focus. If you add some talent and some passion to the mix, and like what we say, Angela Duckworth says, grit. If you add grit into the mix, then I always say that attention is something that we're all losing, but it's the single most thing that can open any door in the universe for you. If you pay enough attention, you go at it with all of these different things, that can happen. And that's probably why a lot of the people who have these clearly written goals, I think Carol Dweck out of UCLA did a study where if you just wrote down your goals, your ability to achieve them increases by 42% just by writing it down. It's incredible. And they repeated this multiple times in our labs. Of course, you've got to take action. Of course, you've got to strategize. Of course, you've got to meet the right people, do the right things. But just by writing something down and having it clearly out there, you know, and we could talk about like you yourself doing this, the universe is helping you, you're manifesting, whatever it might be. But for people, if you're listening today and, you know, just note down what Sahil said, have a clearly defined goal, because it's not enough to just say, oh, I think I might do this and I think I might do that. It's not being specific. Be specific, exactly craft. I always say, like, imagine you were a magician. And you could just, you had, let's take a Harry Potter example. You had a wand, and then you take a spell and you create your perfect life, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. How would you like it to be? Define it as clearly as possible. And then you're going to know what are the things that are going, you should avoid, basically. Because a lot of the times, yeah, competing demands, you can't say no to friends. A lot of these distractions, our brains can process about 11 billion bits of information. Okay, my bad. Let's redo this. Our brains can process 11 bits of information. And every day, just on like just going on the street or listening to radio, we are exposed to 11 billion bits. Hmm. So your brain can only process a little bit. So don't overexpose yourself to so much information. Be intentional, be more conscious about what activities, people, things that you want to engage in and if that has a positive impact in your life. And I mean, I always tell people, like, try everything and just be conscious enough to know that if this is not working, it's probably, you know, you don't want to be inefficient because you could achieve something fast.
So I'd love to give a specific example to this. You know, I made the conscious decision that the specific words were in my head was I want to treat my body like a temple or a mosque or a church or, you know, whatever you believe in. But basically you want to treat your body well. And part of that decision was getting good sleep. Like I thought previously that exercise, but actually my fitness drastically improved when I really started focusing on my sleep. So sleep meant I had to get into a good rhythm. And I decided that I love the mornings, so I want to sleep early-ish. Now, what does early mean? It's relative. Some people, that could be 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. But for me specifically, I wanted to be in bed and asleep somewhere between 10 and 10:30, which allows me to wake up anywhere between 5 and 5:30, naturally without an alarm. Now, when I made that decision that I want to get a good night's rest because of all the benefits that sleep gives, in particular to the body healing, a lot of other decisions became easier. Because if I sleep by 10, 10:30, it means dinner needs to be finished because I want to make sure there's a 3-hour gap between my meal being complete and I fall asleep. So by 7, 7:30, dinner has to be completed, which means I have to make sure that I get home in time for dinner. It meant that I said no to a lot of social events that happened during the week. Of course, there are some exceptions, you know, some friends visit from out of town or it's a very dear friend's birthday. But anything else, my answer is no. It meant that I would stop screen time by a certain time so that it wouldn't interfere with my melatonin levels, which again affect my sleep. So just that one decision, and I can keep going on and on about this, but the point is that one decision allowed for so many other decisions to become crystal clear. So it's amazing. You think that one decision only has a small impact, but that one decision changes the course of so many other areas of your life.
Wow, that's powerful, actually. Never thought of it that way. That's an exercise for you guys to look at. What's that one decision that you can take today and then reverse engineer all of the other things? See how and what kind of an impact that comes into your life and reach out to us after this podcast is released. Tell Sahil and me about it. I'm sure we'll be happy to see what kind of changes people are bringing.
Absolutely.
Okay, so now you mentioned something in the book which talks about people's energy. And you mentioned something along the lines of when you are in certain energetical states or certain attitudes, anything that you will attract any energy that is similar to that energy, and you will repel any energy that is kind of like not similar to that. So a perfect example would be, this is how I understood it. If let's say you're in a bad mood or you're angry, that energetical sequence will actually attract more people in your life that might be angry and say, hey, you did the right thing. You know, you have to be angry. Go punch that person, whatever. And you're right and the person is wrong. And at the same time, you'll have other people in your life who probably don't want to be angry and, you know, would want to, would probably even interfere in your life and tell you like, hey, maybe it wasn't right. You need to take a deep breath or you need to walk out of the room or something. But there's only so many times that that person will try as well before they see that there's no effect and they might walk out. And this is how you might lose very essential people in your life. So what was going on in your, am I right with this analogy? Like, this is what I kind of picked up.
Absolutely. It's definitely along the lines of what I was trying to explain to people. And I want to give an example. I'm going to use family as an example. I feel that everyone can relate to this. You know, I have a member in the family who used to lose their temper a lot. Now, I don't want to highlight who that is. But it was someone who was close enough and someone who I would see on a frequent basis. And over time, even though I love that individual because they're a great human being, but because of the energy that they were giving out, which was you know, getting involved in politics, not by being part of any political party, but just watching the news, and but only hearing one side of it, the side that they're in agreement with, and then, you know, complaining about the other side and how the world is being done wrong as a result of that and whatnot. And so at some point, you know, whether it was the politics or the anger, I just felt that I was not being drawn to that person anymore. So even though there's love, there was conflict within me because I was being repelled, or at least that's how I felt. I don't think they had any intention to repel me, to push me away. But that's the impact that it had on me, because the energy that I was giving out and the energy they were giving out were very much opposites. And so it was like, you know, getting the two pluses of a magnet together, and they're just, you know, it's being repelled, right? It's pushing each other, each side away. And so that's what was happening. And what happened as a result was I distanced myself from this family member. And it's such a shame because, you know, when it's family or a close friend, it can even happen with a close friend. I had a friend who was just constantly negative about everything. And this was a dear friend of mine who I've known since my early teens. And now I'm like, I feel guilty because this is one of my closest friends. But at the same time, I don't really want to be in their presence. And there's only so much I can say. I can keep saying, hey, look at it from a different perspective. How can we change this? You know, you do your best to I wouldn't say help, because, you know, but you're giving love. Mm-hmm. You're giving love. You're hoping that they see things differently or feel things differently, that their energy can shift. But ultimately, they're on their journey. And that's when I had to come to that difficult realization that I'm not in control of someone else. I can barely control myself. So I just let them, I just have to let them walk their path and experience whatever they have to, and just know that I'm there for them. But unfortunately, as a result of this energy conflict, I just couldn't spend as much time with them anymore because it would take me down. And then when I get pulled down, what impact am I having on the loved ones around me? The spouse, the children, the parents, the colleagues. And so I realized that I had to be responsible in the role that I'm in.
Interesting. Wow. You know, when I was reading your book, there was this, I don't even have to look at my notes because I remember this. There was this aha moment for me. Mm-hmm. Because there's a graphic in the book and it says, why worry?
Yeah.
And this was one of those things that I actually ran down to tell my sister. I was like, hey, did you, like, and she was looking at it first. She wasn't paying much attention to me, but I was like, oh my God, like, this is so simple. Like, why didn't I ever, I mean, it might have come to me from different angles, but like, it was a much more super complicated version of it in the book. And we'll try to put the image of this in the video if you guys are watching. But basically, the idea is, and I want you to explain it, it says, why worry? And there are these two circles. And it's like, one says, can you do something about it? And then if it says yes, then you say, why worry? And if you cannot do something about it, yes, then why worry? So in any case, like, I want you to explain this, because this was, for me, it was like, ah,
yeah,
wow. Only if I could know this earlier.
So to give a simple example, it's basically saying, one, the first question is, do you have a situation in life, right? Let's say something's going on. Mm-hmm. But if nothing's going on, then there's nothing to worry about, right? Then it's all good. If something is going on, can you do something about it? If you can do something about it, then go ahead and do something about it, which means you don't have to worry anymore. And if you can't do anything about it because it's out of your control or your circle of influence, then you just accept it. And then again, why worry?
I love it.
So, you know, let's give a classic example. You know, it's like someone who every day sits in their car and worries about the traffic. So let's use traffic as an example. You know, we live in a city where the traffic has increased due to the influx of people that have moved here, as well as the greater number of tourists, which is a great thing. So I can be worried, oh, the traffic's going to be bad, the traffic's going to be bad. But guess what? It's not going to change. So either I sit in my car and accept that it's going to take an extra 15 or 30 minutes to get to wherever it is I want to go, or especially in today's world of flexible working hours, I say, hey, you know what? I'm going to leave much earlier or much later than the peak traffic, and I'll do the same when I leave work. So then I can do something about it. So either you accept the situation because you can't change it or influence it, or you do something about it. But just sitting there and doing neither and worrying about it serves absolutely no purpose.
Or complaining as well. I think a lot of people like keep complaining all the time. I hope it's my really a wish that someone who's watching this podcast picks up this point at least, and someone in the meme culture picks up this point and they start making memes on why worry. This would be epic. Like I can only imagine this going viral. Like people telling each other, why worry? Why worry?
Yeah.
Okay, that's amazing. Okay. So let's talk about some things, and we can be a bit quick here. Like not so quick, but like a fire round.
Sure.
What's the role of acceptance in life?
It's rather simple. You accept the other person for who they are. Mm-hmm. You know, if I don't accept you, it means that I want you to be someone else. And that's not really showing love. You know, the purest form of love is I accept you for who you are with everything that comes with it.
Cool. What's the role of forgiveness?
Forgiveness is such a big topic, but but to simplify it is the best thing I can say is, and I'm going to share a quote by, I believe it's Henry Smeads, if I'm not mistaken, and it goes a little something like this. To forgive is to set the prisoner free, only to realize the prisoner was you.
Interesting.
And I find that people, they always say, oh, I can't forgive the other person. They did this and that and this and that. But it's not about them. It's about freeing yourself. And when you see it from that perspective, because you don't have to go to the other person and say, I forgive you, and then hug them and take them out for lunch or whatever it is. It's not about them. It's about you. And I can't emphasize that enough.
In the beginning of the book, you have this thing where you're saying all these clutters are, it's like a weighted vest or like weights on you, and they're pulling you down. And then how can you jump up or fly or something along those lines, right? I think forgiveness is one of those things where we keep holding on so much within ourselves. And, you know, generations before us had a bigger problem because, again, you'd say it's tied to ego and all of those things. But when you look at all Eastern cultures or like cultures all around the world, there is a very big emphasis on forgiveness. You know, Lao Tzu, Tao Te Ching, or you see there's a series of sayings from the Buddha. It's called the Dhammapada, and most of them focus on forgiveness so much because you're right. It's like a weight or something, like a chain that's holding you down, and you think that is something that is in the other person. Like it's like eating the poison and thinking someone else will die. It doesn't happen.
Absolutely. And I'm going to add to that just to share a lovely exercise that everyone can do.
Okay.
Write a letter of forgiveness. Forget everyone else. To yourself. We've all done things that we're not proud of. That one thing, two, three, or however many things it is. Yeah. Start with yourself. Write a letter of forgiveness to yourself and write that letter. It's so impactful. Because there's one thing I want to say. You're not the same person you were. You know, you talked about all these Eastern philosophies. I think it was the Buddha that said this, is every breath is a new me. So I'm not the person that I was yesterday or even 10 seconds ago. So why am I holding on to the version of me from 10 years back when I'm so different today?
Love that.
So when my wife, you know, I always say this, when she tells me and reminds me of something, something I did 3 years ago or whenever it was in the past, I say, you're absolutely right. That's the old me. The new me would never do that.
Okay, that's something for you guys to take home. If your wife tells you something or your husband tells you something, or your friends tell you something, or your parents tell you something, let them know. That's the old version of you. New version isn't like that. Or at least you're working on yourself. You mentioned, right? Sometimes you have to say no to parties. You have to say no to events. And then this gives rise to something that a lot of the generation today has in capital letters. It's called FOMO. How do you deal with FOMO? Fear of missing out.
When I'm coaching people, this is a very common challenge that people face. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to talk about FOMO. I'm going to talk about fear in general. Mm-hmm. They focus on what's missing rather than what they're going to gain. Mm-hmm. And so I always ask people, okay, sure, perhaps you've missed out on something, but what have you gained as a result? And in my case, and how I had to deal with it internally, was I realized the gain was far, far superior, stronger, better, greater than the loss. And so, you know, it's a simple equation. The net effect is positive. Mm-hmm. Why on earth would I not do it?
Mm-hmm. Have you heard about JOMO?
The joy of missing out.
Yeah, the joy of missing out. So every time I have a FOMO situation, I always tell myself, like, okay, I wish I could be in this situation. I wish I could be in that party, or I wish I could be with my friends. And like you, I have a very strong habit of saying no to all the things that don't serve me or can have an impact on my life the next day, the night, because I can really see it. Like when you're used to operating at a 90% efficiency or a 95% efficiency, any small thing that cuts you back, you notice it the next day, and you notice it for weeks. So I always tell myself, CJ, it's, and my friends will be like, hey, come out with us. We're going to a good place. We're going for this vacation. Oh, this party, this whatever. And I'm like, no, guys, I have a very good JOMO. It's not FOMO anymore. It's JOMO. I'm happy I'm missing this because I know that this time can be used into something more productive that will align with my larger vision, the vision that I have set out in the future.
What you said is amazing because you get into this amazing rhythm. And this rhythm is so beautiful. It sounds great. It feels great. I mean, just last night, I had my nephew in town. And he was only in town and one opportunity to meet. We went for dinner. Dinner was at, by the time the food arrived, maybe 9 p.m. Mm-hmm. And I usually eat at 7. Mm-hmm. As a result, slept later. Mm-hmm. But because of the body clock, still woke up relatively early. And the first thing I told the spouse, well, not the first thing, but one of the first things that I mentioned was, you know, the next few days, I just want to get back into rhythm. Mm. I can't do this again. Because I noticed by eating late and sleeping late, the impact that it had on me today.
Yeah, and it's funny. A lot of people who are listening to this and they say that, oh, we don't feel that impact. Just check at what percent of efficiency are you operating at. If you're operating at 50 or 60%, yeah, you're not going to feel much of a difference. But if you're really giving it your all, if you're operating it at that upper 90 percentile, any small thing, you're going to feel the difference. Sahil, I can keep going on and on talking to you. You're such an interesting guy. You have such good experience, wisdom, stories from so many different aspects of your life that you're sharing in this book. Would you be down to doing a part two of this a few weeks or months later?
Absolutely. And if you give me permission, I'd like to share a closing story.
Yeah.
You know, the sailor, he goes to the captain and he says, Captain, when am I going to get my pay? Mm-hmm. And the captain says, tomorrow. Sailor goes to bed, wakes up the next morning, all excited, thinking about how he's going to spend his money, goes to the captain and goes, Captain, can I get my pay? And the captain looks at him and goes, hey, didn't I tell you tomorrow? Mm-hmm. So this is a message to the audience that tomorrow never comes. Mm. You've heard a lot of nuggets, you know, from this podcast. Take one. Because I know you might be excited like me. Whenever I hear something, I'm like, oh, I'm going to change this and this and this and this. And it's just overwhelming and I never get to changing anything. So I just say, take one thing that resonated with you and start today.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Sahil. If I could put you in a time machine and I can take you back to a younger self, what would be that one piece of advice that you'll tell yourself?
Don't be afraid to be you.
Okay. Don't be afraid to be you. That's where we'll close today. If people want to reach out to you, are you engaging with the public normally? what's the best way to like learn about you or reach out to you? Any exciting thing that you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, people can reach me on through my website, through mm-hmm. social media.
We'll put the links in the show notes.
Excellent. And something exciting that I'm doing is, well, I'm actually one of the many coaches taking part of the world's largest coaching session, which is happening tomorrow.
Wow.
Yeah, I believe there are about 2,500 participants being coached at the same time with over 100 coaches. And so each of us have a cohort of, I think, about 15 to 25 people, depending uh-huh. on how many show up. And we're looking to create a new record. So that's kind of exciting.
Congratulations and good luck to you for that.
Yeah. But most importantly, the reason why I share that is, like everything in life, even though I'm a professional accredited coach, I have a coach. Mm-hmm. You know, people say, Sal, you have a coach. Why do you have a coach? I can't see my blind spots. Mm-hmm. I can't coach myself. It's just I can, to a certain level, I can. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it's impossible. Mm-hmm. And guess what? My coach, who in my eyes is phenomenal, she's just incredible. Mm-hmm. She has a coach. Mm. And so I always tell people that if for those who are looking to become a better version of themselves, ask yourself, what are you missing out on, you know, using the FOMO mm-hmm. analogy, by not having a coach?
Mm-hmm. That's super interesting. Even science tells us that we're much better at following other people's advice. And if we're really bad at following our own advice. And if we replicate the scenarios and put you in the same situation as you're giving an advice to someone, you're going to give better advice. Mm. That person's going to follow because it's not you that himself who's giving the advice. So that's amazing. Check out your blind spots. Find someone, a coach, a mentor, someone who can guide you through life. People have seen more than you. They're more experienced than you. They have walked the path than you. And also coaching, I also would like to tell everyone, it's not something new. We've had this for a millennia. Before, we used to live in tribes and there was always a village elder and that was your coach because he's probably gone through 2 to 3 marriages. He's fought with a tiger. He knows all the paths to the river. It's always good when you have someone's influence that can show you the right path because, as Sahil said, you cannot see your blind spots. And that's it for today. Sahil, thank you for coming. And I look forward to seeing you again.
See you next time.
See you next time. And this is me, CJ, your host, signing out of the Shift with CJ podcast. Everyone have a great day, a great week, a great lifetime. And remember, whenever is the right time, when you talk to yourself, be authentic, give yourself permission to be you and get rid of all the labels, please, especially the ones that are not serving you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Take care, guys.